Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 43, section 4, which is old single column, page 489. All right. To the previous section, recall, they gave you the little synopsis of the three most highs. And now we have the companion. As Elle mentioned, just as at the local universe headquarters level, where you have, you know, the foundation for the local universe domain of the dual administration, you know, of the Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit, you know, that dual administration in contrast to the Trinity administration that's above the local universe level. But you do have an advisor of that Trinity government, above the local universe level, that is there at the Creator Son and Creative Mother Spirit's side, the union of days, that keeps, not only keeps the Ancients of Days above, the rulers above, in very intimate awareness of what's going on down in the trenches of all the local universes. You know, there's a union of days at the headquarters of each local universe. But there's one more notch down of that that linkage up to the Ancients of Days. You have the Faithful of Days, one Faithful of Days, just like there's one union of days. There's one Faithful of Days that is at the headquarters of each constellation. So they're at the side of the three Most Highs, most immediately at the side of the Most High, the Constellation Father. There, if they want some advice, if they ask for some advice about how the Trinity government sees things, there's an individual right there. So that's who we're going to be talking about, and you'll see in the process of this section, they bring in some other things because of the way they're leveraging off of Bible passages, some other elements that are naturally covered in this context. Why don't you just read that first tiny little one-sentence paragraph, and then they make a comment on the title of the section and stuff.
Number 4. Mount Assembly, the Faithful of Days. The most holy Mount of Assembly is the dwelling place of the Faithful of Days, the representative of the Paradise Trinity who functions on Edentia.
Okay, so the first thing, and we've talked about this quite a bit, it's really come into play a lot as we've gotten into the constellation level, this whole issue of the Revelator's use of all of our names that we have, proper names that they've taken a hold of to use for beings, taking them out of the immediate specificity that we use them for, but drawing upon the context that they're in and using those names to designate the various beings, not having a whole bunch of names all just designating the one monotheistic God, but spreading them out over a whole bunch of beings. And also various passages in the Bible that have useful designations or turns of phrase, like the ancient of days, expression being spread out over unions of days, faithfuls of days, just playing off of that in parallel. Or here, there is a famous passage in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 14, if I recall correctly, that talks about the Mount of Assembly, quote-unquote. It uses that expression. know, so they're going to play off of that to designate this highland region where the Faithful of Days residence is located. And as we get into it, you'll see why. There's a whole bunch of facts that stem off of that immediate passage and that which immediately precedes it there in Isaiah. So they've sort of built the whole use of language kind of around that passage in Isaiah. Depending on what translation you see, you know, you might literally see Mount of Assembly. You might see them translating that Hebrew word as a designation like congregation rather than assembly. But, you know, same idea the revelators have chosen to use the assembly designation. So there's just, you know, this quote-unquote Mount of Assembly. And I'll explain the immediate context that's in the Bible when we get to the passage. But they're going to use that for this dwelling place of the Faithful of Days. And one of the reasons that is called the Faithful of Days that goes beyond some of the things they say directly about that when they first introduced that term, you know, way back when we read all of the different of days. You know, in this immediate context, you'll see another way to understand the validity of picking that designation for this being. Because of the level that he's serving at, the constellation level, which is that fundamentally integrous level above where there can be rebellion. You know, rebellion can only occur at the local system level and below. But if you get up to the constellation level, it's rock solid. It's faithful. You know, that is a faithful level. So it also works that way. To appreciate just as rock solid as the Verondadics are, like we read last time, you know, you have at their side, you know, this further literal expression of that integrity of this level with the Faithful of Days. All right. And remember, all those of days are, you know, their only parent, quote-unquote, is the Paradise Trinity. They're all created just by the Paradise Trinity, not by the Father, not by the Son, not by the Spirit. You know, the three persons are not involved. They're created just by the Paradise Trinity. Let's see. And remember again the literal meaning of the word Eden in Hebrew means delight. Right. Just kind of keep that in mind. You know, you might see occasionally them using that word and just, you know, appreciate, see how they're actually playing off of the literalness. As you're in this delightful domain, you know, by them choosing to call this Adentia, another way to think about it, it's a very delightful domain. Many, many rich delights that we'll get to a little bit later in the paper, even more so. But all right, so that's the. You see, you know, by having just that tiny little paragraph, they want you to actually get yourself as much recognition as possible right up front, and then proceed in. You know, they're often expecting you to know all of the famous Bible passages. You know, I mean, they're using them. They're expecting that the reader is, you know, is like readers of old, you know, who knew the Bible very well. And so many things go right over your head if you aren't familiar with the Bible, because they're using it very, very freely.
Politicians knew the Bible too back in Lincoln's time.
Right. Everyone used to know the Bible, especially
just freely.
Right. Especially all the famous passages. Right. Yeah. That you can use, you know, as analogies and what, you know, we were playing our recognition off of the Bible all the time. Yeah. Okay.
The Faithful of Days is a Trinity son of Paradise and has been present on Adentia as the personal representative of Emmanuel since the creation of the headquarters world. Even the Faithful of Days stands at the right hand of the constellation fathers to counsel them. but never does he proffer advice unless it is asked for. The high sons of paradise never participate in the conduct of the affairs of a local universe, except upon the petition of the acting rulers of such domains. But all that a union of days is to a creator son, a faithful of days is to the most highs of a constellation.
Okay, so you see, I basically already made that point there about how very, very parallel this relationship is between the actual administration within the local universe and this parallel Trinity representative by their side. You notice how they use the expression Trinity Son. If that catches you off guard because you're in the mode of thinking of creator sons and magisterial sons and whatnot, and you're going, wait a minute, I didn't think they were sons. Remember how they use that designation, stationary sons? You have all those, all the of days, and then the divine counselors, the perfectors of wisdom, and those without name and number. No, those without name and number. Yeah, that's what I mean, isn't it? Wait a minute. Divine counselor, universal censors, perfectors of wisdom. Yeah, I was getting off on the other ones. All right, just those three. Divine counselors, universal censors, and perfectors of wisdom. And then all of the of days and the Trinitized secrets of supremacy. Those are stationary sons of the Trinity. That's why they're bringing in the sun thing. And it actually, it helps in this context to designate, refer to him that way. When they use, here they bring in Emmanuel again. And, as we've pointed out, there's a name that we've used. We use it as a synonym for Jesus, in the New Testament. And okay, but no, they're not using it as a synonym for Jesus or a synonym for anything else. They're going to use it as a name for the Union of Days. And if you think about the literalness of that Hebrew, remember it means God with us. El is God. God with us. And, so you go, well, that's not very specific. How would that distinguish our union of days from some other union of days? I mean, are they saying that only ours is God with us and no other union of days? See, obviously not. They're not using it to somehow differentiate our union of days from some other one, like we have different names so that we can keep ourselves straight. They're just using that as a way of reminding you of something about the truth of that being. You're going, well, wait, how could it be God with us? Because especially if I just say God, I'm supposed to think of the universal Father, aren't I? And we were just saying these of days beings are not from the Father, they're from the Paradise Trinity. The reason is at the top in the temporal domain of the of days is the Ancients of Days, and they are God, they're personalized deity. Unions of Days, Faithfuls of Days aren't God. They're not personalized deity. They're divine. They're not God. The Ancients of Days are not only God, but they are the super fathers. In a hierarchy of fathers, you can think of the Havona father being downstepped to the super fathers. So even though they're Trinity origin, they function as the super fathers of a super universe. And so their direct representatives are, quote unquote, God, in that sense, with us. So it would be literally the creator son and the creative mother spirit that would turn to Emmanuel and say, this is God with us, the God above, the super fathers. I see. So that's the sense they're using it in. And Emmanuel is in Isaiah there as well. We're playing some more in this context of Isaiah. leveraging off of passages in Isaiah. Okay, so the faithful days stands at the right hand of the constellation Phlegethon to counsel them. It's just like the union of days. Just a council. They never participate in the conduct of affairs of a local universe except upon the petition of the acting rulers of such domains. So they have no authority to jump in and take over. You know, even when Emmanuel is temporarily running the local universe, when Michael is in his seventh pistol, he didn't usurp the local universe from Michael. I mean, Michael handed it to him. Right? They would all be, any of them would be in rebellion if they were to stick their more transcendent perspective into the evolutionary process. That's not allowed. The evolutionary process needs to play out for ages upon ages to finally get a local universe settled in light and life. You know, and there's no shortcuts that can come through one of these of days beings by whispering in the ears of the rulers and saying, here's how you could skip several billion years. Right? There is no such thing. They just let it play out. All right. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? So let's keep going here.
The residence of the Adentia Faithful of Days is the constellation center of the paradise system of extra-universe communication and intelligence. These Trinity sons, with their staffs of Favona and Paradise personalities, in liaison with the supervising union of days, are in direct and constant communication with their order throughout all the universes, even to Havona and Paradise.
Okay, so you have this sort of separate connectivity thing. It's like I said, I mean, there's this whole linkage up the whole hierarchy of days, and you can tell it has a separateness to it. That whole information channel getting up to the Ancients of Days is separate from all of the regular communications that are going on. They have a little backdoor channel that is keeping an eye on everything.
The thought occurred to me, could this be, mildly analogous to the thought adjuster and us? I mean, the thought personally, because the thought adjuster is kind of coming down from this higher administration, so to speak, bestowing only upon us when we agree. Just like the rulers, when they invite those paradise personalities to inform them.
Yeah, for those of you on the webinar, he's pointing out a really good analogy between, the faithful of days and the most highs, and with us, compared to, in parallel to us and the adjuster, just as the faithful of days, you could say is always subservient to the will of the Most Highs. Remember how they say that directly about the adjuster. Your adjuster is always subservient to your will. Yeah, so that's a great little analogy, and it's that way in parallel because the evolutionary process is supreme, and it's welling up. But you always have that's above reaching down to engage. As an initiating spark, or as a catalyst, or as an aid, if you reach the level of recognition of asking for that aid and do, but it's never going to impose itself. That downwelling ministry is not going to impose itself upon the evolutionary process and presume upon it. Yeah.
On the web, we have David. He said, the use that is made of scriptural quotes in the way that is often used here seems very contrived and superficial to me. Sorry to say. For years, I have felt such. Yep. Any perspective or advice that would help me deal with this take on UB usage?
It is contrived. They don't hold... the Bible sacred? It's not a sacred text. You know, they just pick it up with a pair of scissors in their hand and start cutting. And, you know, and they cut this thing out and they erase that and they write in a word in its place. And right, I mean, so, you know, the reason it feels that way to you, you know, is, you know, we have this long, steeped tradition of, you know, it's a sacred text. It's the capital S scriptures. And, you know, there is no reverence like that, you know, I guess you'd say. There is recognition of usefulness. You're going, oh, well, that's a good you know, sequence of words. I could use that sequence of words. But that's true of everything that humans have written, not just the Bible. And remember again, it's not just in the Jesus papers, but everywhere in the book. If they can find some sequence of words that a human has written that's adequate to the task of expressing what they have to say, they must use that. Doesn't matter how high a being they are, they have to, you know, put their perspective subservient to our sequence of words. Even if it means, you know, there's a little distortion in it, they're counting on you to overcome that. But again, there, you know, it's that whole respect for the God the Supreme, the God of evolution and the evolutionary process. We have to find truth through the evolutionary process, not by some complete, perfect fiat thing dropped in our lap that we just read and then poof, we, you know, we're on paradise. You know, this book is not like that. It's not a sacred text, and it doesn't have that sort of magical quality, you know, that you can just turn your brain off and just, you know, let the words flow in and it all just magically happens. You have to overcome all of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, long-standing prejudices. You have to overcome that they couldn't find any better set of words, but this one is adequate enough if you're on your toes enough. You know, if you're not on your toes, it's not going to be adequate enough. You know, you're going to get more distortion of meaning, not less. You know, you have to always be on your best, most objective, active mind, or you're just going to, you know, acquire a ball of goo out of these pages. You know, that's not going to get you anywhere. You'll just misinterpret every single thing you read. If you're thinking somehow it's self-contained and, you know, sort of explains itself or, you know, clarifies itself. It does not. It's an evolutionary process to engage it. And it requires the best wisdom and insight and foresight that you can muster to keep from going astray with it.
I gave it to I was talking to my hairdresser about it last week. And so she texted me yesterday and said, what's the name of that book again? Mm-hmm. And I said, Urantia. Now, I'm just wondering, you know, what she's going to do with it.
Well.
Probably put it back on the shelf.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and an awful lot of people, they're not likely to muster enough engagement that they immediately go off into error and evil. It'll just kind of be a passive lack of recognition, and it kind of just won't go anywhere. You know, when I say some of these things about, you know, challenging yourself, I mean, I'm assuming that you're in this room because you want to go beyond a superficial relationship with it. You know, and if you are earnest in that desire, then you've got to know that the moment you go beyond the surface, there is great demands being made of you. Because you're trying to go from fact to truth. The fact is on the page. The words are fact. Not one shred of truth in the words. You're trying to go from the fact that is on the page to truth, a journey that very few in human history have achieved. Most, when they try to branch off from fact and get to truth, they go to error. You know, and that's just as true with us as anyone else that's ever lived. It doesn't matter how much you want to go to truth. It's not automatic. The thing that's much more automatic is going to error, because we're a long ways down from the kind of integrity that we're reading about right here, where it's much more automatic to go from fact to truth. We're very ignorant. There's very, you know, we know almost nothing about anything. Right? So you want to go very slowly, very cautiously, very methodically, constantly challenging your interpretation, you know, trying to put it to the test, because there's a high probability that your first effort is going to be erroneous. You got to be willing to discover that, let go of it, try again.
That takes a lot of effort.
Takes a lot of effort, struggle, conflict. Right? You know? Yeah. 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 Here, I got his first, then I'll get to you. Yep.
Follow up on the other. This kind of take on scripture is not helpful in introducing the book to people who value and respect scripture. At least to my way of thinking.
Yes. Yeah. See, notice. You know. You've got to recognize this. I mean, if someone really treats the Bible as very sacred, and, you know, I mean, they may be, you know, only one particular translation is even valid, you know, they start reading, you know, and they know their Bible, and they know that this thing just changed that sentence. And that's going to be an abomination. You know, I mean, you got to recognize this. This is not for someone who, you know, is timid like that.
Locked down.
Right? They have to be courageous, be willing. You know, remember there was only one apostle that Jesus could take aside and kind of begin to inform him about the nature of the Hebrew Scriptures. I mean, he knew that Peter and John and those other guys, they couldn't handle that. The guys that the church were built upon couldn't handle the truth about the Hebrew Scriptures. You know, Nathaniel could, you know, but we don't call it St. Nathaniel's Basilica. All right? So, you know, remember that the evolutionary stream is pretty limited. And most of the apostles were very much in the evolutionary stream. You know, there was a couple of them in certain ways that weren't quite so, you know, immersed in the evolutionary stream. And Jesus could treat them as a parallel and help them to find truth that those in the evolutionary stream are just incapable of finding. You know, and if you tried to really shove it in their face, it would be so confusing. It would probably snuff the faint flicker of faith that they've got going the way it is. It would be much more negative than positive. Right? The revelation of all the epical revelations, there's never been one that's even been remotely more the case of what I'm just saying. This is so for so few. There are so few that can handle what's really here. And the more you know what's really here, the more you recognize there's very few that can handle it. And in every way you can think about it, if someone is timid, you know, or highly ideological or fundamentalist in their thinking, you know, in any way that you can think of being fundamentalist, you know, fundamentalist politically or whatever, any sort of, you know, really bound to the past, you know, what fundamentally you mean by being fundamentalist, if they're bound to the past in some sense of sacredness, you know, this is not for them. They have to have become dissatisfied with the past, the present, and the future as they imagine it, and are ready for a whole new panorama, a whole new political viewpoint, a whole new economic viewpoint, a whole new scientific viewpoint, a whole new set of ideas about God. Every idea of God that you've ever have is going to be washed away, so that you can find those core ideals, things that aren't ideas, the things that are actually ideals that might actually be genuine. You can find those in the midst of your ideology. You can get a hold of those ideals firmly. You know, the faint little wisps of genuine relationship to ideal that we've been given kind of by grace. You can let go of all the ideas that have been falsely constructed from those ideals, those vague, shadowy ideals, and you can start anew and build a whole new idea set. And that's what it's for. You know, it's not for someone who, you know, doesn't have any notion of ideals yet, and they're looking for someone to just inspire them into relationship to ideals for the first time. That's the fourth epical revelation. You know, and that gets spread out there not by part four of the book, because part four of the book's not the fourth epical revelation. It's part of the fifth. You know, if part four, if the fourth epical revelation was something like part four, Jesus would have left written word. Right? I mean, part of him not leaving any written word is to try to get it through our thick skulls that what he was trying to do is not something that can be written down. It's something can only be possessed within your temple within. Right? He wants you to have a faith equal to his. Not similar, equal to his. And he wants you to go out and live that faith amongst those who need to be made aware of the existence of ideals, and through you they will find them, right? And then maybe in way down the road in this life or in future lives, they can start to think about reworking their whole worldview and their ideas about God and all these sorts of things. You know, like what I was just saying several times tonight, that the Paradise Trinity is not the association of three persons. That's the first triunity. The Paradise Trinity is a fourth entity, not an association of three. Things like that, that idea. That's an idea that just, I mean, you know, that's an abomination to anyone who's really hardcore about the Trinity of Christendom. They're not going to accept that. It's bad enough that the three persons are not, you know, the Universal Father, Jesus, and that ghost thingy, you know, whatever the heck the various Christians decide that that third person is, you know, a dove or something, right? You know, I mean, you know, they have a hard time even kind of getting a definitive set of three persons. They've got two pretty definitively, right? But even there, you know, it's like, no, there is a Universal Father. He's a lot bigger than anything you ever imagined. The second person is the Eternal Son, not a Creator Son. And the third person is something infinitely beyond anything you ever imagined. You know, and very complicated to even begin to understand. And so, you know, all these sorts of things. I know we've kind of gone off on a long tangent here, but, you know, just to appreciate, you know, this is, every time this comes up, we should think about this and talk about this some more again. Because there can't be any confusion about this, any delusion about this. You know, it's, you've got to understand what this book is. It's not what most people need. You find someone, it's obvious they need something. It's not likely it's this. They probably don't have the third epical revelation yet. Can you show them the third? You know, they're not even ready for love and service yet. They're not ready for the fourth yet. They don't even, you know, understand trust and faith yet. Right? And we've talked about that a lot. There's an awful lot that we all need to do to have something besides faith, to actually have a good hold on the third epical revelation and have the other part of it, the trust part, instead of faith and a bunch of fear about this chemical and that person and, you know, and whatnot. We're constantly fearing something, right? You know, Jesus said step one to do the fourth epical revelation is fear not, because it's built upon the third. It's built on trust, not fear. Right? And so, I mean, it's such a huge challenge for most people on the planet to even get to the fourth. Now, you had something, John?
No.
Okay. Was there something? Okay. Okay. Was there something else too? Was it? Yeah.
If somebody was influenced and went through the seminary, like your mom.
Mm-hmm.
How is it? Do you? What kind of approach would they take to the book? I mean, how possible?
I mean, the more formal education, like I was kind of just alluding to a little bit ago. You have of Christian history and of the Bible. If you combine that with a courageous openness to more of the story of reality, you're a long ways ahead of the run-of-the-mill person who doesn't have all of that detailed education, doesn't appreciate, oh, they're alluding to that long-standing confusion amongst theologians about that passage. You know, I mean, they're constantly doing that stuff, you know, especially up in part four. You know, so you would be right there, you know, like, you know, I know a lot about particle physics, you know, so I can be reading something like, oh, they're referring to that issue in particle physics there. You know, they don't say it, you know, in black and white. It's often just a suggestion or an illusion or something. And you have to be on top of it enough to pick up on that. Right? And so, I mean, any definitive relationship you have to human philosophy of any flavor, that gives you a leg up. Because you're trying to... you've got a great big huge book here of divine revelation. You have to have at least as much human philosophy to combine with it in order to get have it be a balance and to get the super additive result that they're looking for from it. You know, this is at best half of what you need. You know, it's not even remotely the whole of what you need. You know, if you don't know you know, a particular field at a full level, you can't get the fullness of the super additive consequence that they're looking for by combining that human philosophy with the divine revelation. You know, and it doesn't, you know, if it's a religious context, you need the philosophy tied to that religion. Or if it's a scientific context, you need the philosophy tied to that science. You don't, not just the science or the religion, you know. Yep.
David says most helpful would be studies in philosophy and comparative religion, or maybe a class that's starting this fall.
That's right.
Right, you know, for those of you who are familiar with Perfecting Horizons Institute, that's certainly why, one of the reasons why we have that foundational course that I've developed, Reawakening Philosophy. It's not meant to get into the weeds of the last 2,600 years of human, you know, attempts to think about things in some objective way, but it's you know, but the purpose is to try to get your mind in the proper frame that just doesn't happen naturally at all, especially in the, you know, this age, to get your mind in the kind of frame that can begin to recognize, begin to resonate with the revelation like they're wanting you to. You know.
Chris, could we review for David simply how many topics it covers, that Fullerton covers in that class?
I mean, if we have a weekend to do that.
Right. I mean, you know, like he's just saying, you know, I mean, it's this vast, you know, we spend
space and time and everything.
Right.
It covers all the topics of the Urantia.
It's 15 3-hour classes. It's, you know, 45 hours to just give an initial, you know, survey. And that's just the first half, you know. Reawakening too, as well, right? You know, so it's 90 hours, just to kind of, as a step one, to start to get, you know, I mean, part of doing it was to help improve my relationship to human philosophy, so I can improve my potential in relationship to the revelation. I'm trying to potentialize my relationship to the revelation, you know, so I can get some actuality out of the revelation. All right, meanwhile, back on the Holy Mount. Let's see, so, all right, so we were in that third paragraph there, we were this whole bit about right, you know, not only communication, but remember the one of the key things that's going on in this sort of parallel relationship to the local universe is that intelligence line. You know, that there's quote unquote spies. You know, the universe on high is keeping an eye on what's going on down below. And even if someone down below doesn't recognize something's going on, those on high do. And they're never caught off guard. And then the one other little thing in there, every once in a while, as you're reading out here in the book in general, away from the Central Universe paper, you know, you stumble on a statement like this. So you have these faithfuls of days with their staffs of Havona and Paradise personalities. You know, that ought to, you know, give you some pause every time you read it. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing to think of, that you can get to the constellation level as all and have a conversation with a Paradise personality or a Havona native. Right? Beings that have gone through a very difficult process to somehow get themselves in relationship to time so that they can be out here and have any relationship to what's going on out here. You know, they don't just jump on a jumbo jet on and fly off of Paradise and come out here and start playing around. I mean, especially if they're coming from Paradise, they got zero relationship with even the way my mind works or anything. That is completely different, right? They know nothing but eternity. They know nothing about time. You know, and they've managed to go through some incredible process that's a reciprocal of what we have to go through to get up to eternity. They've gotten out of eternity and into time. You know, so they can be on a staff of a faithful of days. You know, just don't let that just pass by. I mean, that's just an incomprehensible thing. You know, how it is that they can be out here and have any relationship to what's going on. The incredible effort they went through to downstep themselves like that as we're trying to upstep ourselves.
Kind of core they call that.
Yeah, and, you know, remember, and the only way they can do it is, you know, we have to leverage off them to get up and they have to leverage off us to get down. Yeah. Right? Now, of course, for them, they're not going down, they're going up. They're trying to transcend their starting point. They started just lowly on Paradise. They would love to go higher than that. Right? Everything is higher than Paradise, basically, remember. You know, the Isle of Paradise is just the core of existential reality. All of experiential reality is transcendent existential reality. There's nowhere up. You know, except, you know, nowhere but up from Paradise. You know, that's going to be a very cool experience to have some relationship, you know, this early on with those beings. All right, let's keep going here.
The Most Holy Mount is exquisitely beautiful and marvelously appointed, but the actual residence of the Paradise Sun is modest in comparison with the central abode of the Most Highs and the surrounding 70 structures comprising the residential unit of the Rondedex Sons. These appointments are exclusively residential. They are entirely separate from the extensive administrative headquarters buildings wherein the affairs of the constellation are transacted.
It's all pretty straightforward, just, you know, the point, you know, if it isn't obvious, you know, is imagine how much is going on at the Constellation headquarters. You know, how much stuff is feeding into that. 100 local systems, you know, each eventually with roughly 1,000 inhabited worlds, billions upon trillions of beings, and all of that is feeding into, I mean, just imagine the size of the complexes. I mean, how many, you know, what we would call bureaucrats, you know, how many administrators, you know, are filling vast, giant buildings like you see in Washington, D.C., you know, in order to handle all this input. That's what they're referring to. You're just going to be agog at the massiveness of this, you know, this place. And then there's this little humble abode where the faithful of days lives, you know. It's just going to be a stark contrast. All right.
The residence of the faithful of days on Adentia is located to the north of these residences of the Most Highs and is known as the Mount of Paradise Assembly. On this consecrated highland, the ascending mortals periodically assemble to hear the Son of Paradise tell of the long and intriguing journey of progressing mortals through the 1 billion perfection worlds of Avona and on to the indescribable delights of paradise. And it is at these special gatherings on Mount Assembly that the Marantia mortals become more fully acquainted with the various groups of personalities of origin in the central universe.
Did anyone notice what I told you to keep a heads up for? A word that passed by in that paragraph? So, 1 billion perfection worlds of Avona and on to the indescribable delights, right, of paradise. Right, you're in the midst of this land of delight, Adentia, and it's describable. But then there's indescribable delights. See, they're purposely playing off of the, you know, the literal Hebrew meaning of the word there, wanting you to feel that contrast. You know, seeing right there it is, you know, that you'll become more fully acquainted with the various groups of personalities of origin in the central universe. And you notice that they don't say the personalities of the central universe, of origin, and, you know, they've been radically modified to come out, you know, to come out and have a relationship to what's going on out here, you know, in the finite time and space domain. But, you know, it'll be a long time before you can relate to them in a more raw form, an unmodified form, you know, when you're actually there.
Do you feel that they'll be physically modified? Or are they just changing their outfits?
Any modification is holistic, you know, when you go beyond, you know, this initial life. I mean, even in your next life, you know, in the first mansion world, you know, to change your mind is to change your whole body. Right? It's a complete package, right? So they don't look like they look in the central universe even anymore. I mean, they're you know, if you looked at Michael before he was a master son and Michael after he's a master son, you wouldn't even recognize him. He looks so completely different. I mean, he literally has different deity in his nature. I mean, his whole luminosity would have changed. Everything about him is different now that he's a master son. Behold, all things are becoming new. I mean, he completely transforms himself. Right? Right, and yeah, right. I mean, just like they point. I mean, just if any of us had gone through any range of the psychic circles, the contrast between what someone would experience, you know, from us as a fifth circler compared to a second circler, right? Just your whole countenance is just completely different because your mind is so transcendent of what it was when you were a fifth circler. You know, nothing moves the same or anything anymore. You know, a lot of times we recognize someone because they move their mouth the same way or their hands the same way or whatever, you know. The transformation can begin here. You know, and just imagine if you take off the constraints of, you know, there's a limit to how much I can reform shape of my fingers and stuff, right? I'm a blob of protoplasm. But if I'm, you know, much more malleable, right? Your whole appearance, you know, changes all the way up your ascension. Okay, so let's see, what else do we have there? So you had to see the quote-unquote Mount of Paradise Assembly. Obviously, there isn't, the sentence is not going to have Paradise Assembly in the Bible, but the quotes are there because they're reminding you of the Bible passage. And you'll see, we're just about to them, quote-unquote, quoting the Bible passage. When they say the residence of the faithfuls of days on Adentia is located to the north, you'll see that's tied to the passage, the Bible passage. But in the more immediate context here, remember I was telling you that it's the northern hemisphere that is the gardens, the garden hemisphere, that we're going to read about in a couple sections? It's like, well, how do you know that? Well, it's because you have, you know, near the pole, you have all of the headquarters worlds, and you go north to that to get to the faithfuls of days, you have residents. So which pole is the administrative headquarters at? It's obviously at the South Pole. You can't go north from the North Pole to get to the, you know, to the faithfuls of days, you know, residents. All right, see, so it indirectly is telling you that it's the South Pole that the administrative headquarters is on. You're going north up to the faithfuls of days. You know, you keep going north, you get to the northern hemisphere where the gardens are. The whole southern hemisphere, you know, is all about all of this, all the personal doings and stuff.
Yeah. Well, recognizing the size of the sphere,
right?
You're doing some traveling.
Right, you're talking about, remember, it's a sphere the size of the sun.
Yeah.
Travel faster.
Right, it's not a bus.
It's a great big sphere, yeah.
Yeah.
Chris, how does that compare to the first layout of Eden, the way it was constructed? What did they have in the north in Eden, the first Garden of Eden? Because they were very specific on what, you know, the north, they had this.
Good question. I'd have to go back and look. That's a great question to see if there's some.
There's got to be some tie-in.
Yeah, there might be. That's a great thought. I hadn't thought of checking that out.
You're saying the south is all the personal administration.
Well, it's all the, you know, all the administrative and whatnot sort of stuff. You know, just all, where all the people stuff happens.
Okay.
And then there's the gardens.
The gardens are to the north.
Yeah, the gardens is the whole northern hemisphere. Yeah.
Separate.
Where's the Sea of?
Down there towards, around by the South Pole.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we were talking about that earlier when they mentioned this. You know, it's a little hard to tell if which is exactly at the South Pole, if the Sea of Glass is exactly at the South Pole, or the Most High's, you know, headquarters is exactly, it's a little hard to tell which is precisely at the pole, but you know, it's all immediate in the polar region. Yeah. All right, let's see. I think that's everything there. So now let's actually get to that passage in Isaiah that they keep playing off of here.
The residence of the faithful of days on, is the next one, isn't it?
Yeah.
The traitorous Lucifer,
yeah.
One time sovereign of Satania, is announcing his...
In and out.
Oh, boy. I better start over. The traitorous Lucifer, one time sovereign of Satania, in announcing his claims to increased jurisdiction, sought to displace all superior orders of sonship in the governmental plan of the local universe. He purposed in his heart, saying, I will exalt my throne above the sons of God, and I will sit upon the Mount of Assembly in the north. I will be like the Most High.
Okay, so, you know, I mean, even the, you know, in so many words, he purposed in his heart saying, okay, even that is in the Bible, is in Isaiah. It's not just the part that's in quotes there. If you know that passage at all, you're struck by some of the changes, just like we were talking about. If you want them to be directly quoting what's in Isaiah, you don't get it here. And you're thinking, well, what right do they have to be changing things like this? Do you want affirmation of some poor soul many, many centuries ago who was struggling to try to have some relationship with reality. He might have even been getting help from the Melchizedek receivers, but still he's struggling to try to have some relationship with reality. Do you want that, affirmation of that, or do you want revelation? I mean, you have to make a decision about what you want to put first here. And the interesting thing, you know, that is that you see immediately coming into play here is, wait a minute, we didn't seem to be talking about the traitorous Lucifer here. You know, why are they bringing that in? Well, it's because if you know that passage in Isaiah, immediately before, directly immediately before this passage is the one passage, if you're in, if you're looking like in the King James Version, where the word Lucifer appears in the Bible. I mean, you know, in most modern Bibles, the word Lucifer doesn't appear at all. But if you go back to the King James, it appears that one time right before this, okay? And why does it appear? Well, it isn't because they're talking about the Lucifer they're referring to here. You know? I mean, who's Isaiah talking about in this passage? He's talking about the king of Babylon. Okay? And you know, they're in Palestine, and you know, Babylon is to the east. Does the sun rise in the east or the west? Sun rises in the east. If Venus is near the sun at sunrise, just before the sun rises, you'll see Venus above the horizon, and then the sun comes up, and then it's too bright, and you can't see Venus anymore. Venus, when it's there just before sunrise, is called the morning star. Right? And we've talked about this many times. There's the morning star like that, or if you see Venus close to the sun just after the sun sets, and so the sun goes down and now the sky's dark, and there's Venus above the horizon, and then it sets. That's the evening star. Right? There's the morning star and the evening star, which is actually not a star, it's Venus. Right? And every culture had a personification, a god, for that planet. And they didn't know that it was the same planet in the morning and the evening. Right? So they had two different god names for the two. And in Latin, the name of that personification of the morning star is Lucifer. Right? And the name of the personification of the evening star is Vesper. That's why you have Vespers, you know, for evening prayers. Right? Right. So, okay, right. So what's actually in there is not the word Lucifer. I mean, the Hebrews are not using that Latin, you know, designation. The Hebrews are referring to the morning star in the east. You know, so here you are in Palestine. You're looking to Mesopotamia and Babylon, you know, to the east. And, you know, he's saying, you know, you king of Babylon, you think you're the morning star. You know, you think you're that god in the heavens to the east. You know, well, let me explain to you how lowly you actually are. You know, you're not exalted into the heavens like that. I mean, that's what he's talking about. Right? He's just using the whole morning star thing to, to indicate a false exaltation of the Babylonian king by him, you know, his self-exaltation. Right, but, in modern times, or maybe I should say recent times, we've turned that morning star designation into an alternate designation for the evil one. Right? And see, this is one of the reasons why, I mean, this is really the main reason why they decided to call the system sovereign who rebelled, why they decided to call him Lucifer. Okay? It's because if you have an old translation of the Bible, where they actually replace morning star by the word Lucifer, right? You know, if you read a modern one, you know, like that one right there on the table, it'll just say morning star, right? If you have an older one that has Lucifer there, right after that passage is this one, which they're saying, even though Isaiah was talking about the king of Babylon, this very well describes exactly what was going on in the system sovereign's head. So we can use that to describe what was going on in his heart, right? See, in his temple, the temple within his mind. And if you do that, well, then it's appropriate to use the name Lucifer for the system sovereign so that the two link up.
Interesting.
Okay. See, that's why they're using that name, Lucifer.
What about the bright and morning star?
Right. And so in the book of Revelation, you have a line that doesn't just say morning star, it says bright and morning star. And so they go, okay, there's another name. Let's use that for Gabriel, you know, or you have, you know, the general designation of the brilliant evening star. You know, Venus is very brilliant in the sky, right? It's the brilliant evening star. It's like, okay, there's another phrase they have. Let's use that for those beings, right? See, they're just taking anything, any phrase, any name they can find. You know, and technically, the bright morning star and Lucifer are describing the exact same thing, Venus in the morning, right? But they're using them for, like, complete opposites, right? They're using one for, you know, the guy that went iniquitous is the system sovereign, and they're using the other one as a category designation for, you know, the group that Gabriel's in. And right. See, so just like we were talking about, I mean, if you're not willing to for them to take scissors to the Bible like that and just use it freely, you know, you can't relate to what's in this book. You know, I mean, one of the main problems with modern people, it's one of the reasons why a modern translation doesn't say Lucifer in Isaiah anymore, is because everyone thinks that's talking about the iniquitous, you know, one or the evil one or whatever. And that, if they thought that, that would totally corrupt the passage. No, it's talking about the king of Babylon. Don't bring in Satan or something here, you know. But a lot of people, it's like, well, oh, they just took Lucifer out of the Bible. This passage is about, no, it's about the king of Babylon. It's not, you're not supposed to be going off on that tangent. You know, so modern scholars are trying to avoid people going off on that false tangent and thinking that passage is actually about the Lucifer we always talk about.
But in truth, right? It describes, not in fact, yeah. In truth, right. It describes Lucifer's mind.
Right.
What the king of Babylon was doing to those right. Limited scope of mentality of that day.
Right.
And
yeah.
For a wider scope of mentality.
Right. In fact, Isaiah was describing what was in the king of Babylon's mind. But in truth, the revelers are saying, you know, that works just completely adequate. If we tweak a couple things, instead of saying above the stars of God, let's change it to say above the sons of God and capitalize the S. All right, so if they tweak it a little bit, right? You know, and we won't say in the far north, we'll just say in the north, because, you know, because the Bible passage says far north, but it's actually... You know, they don't want you to think that the Faithful of Days headquarters is far to the north of the Most High's headquarters. So they, you know, they drop the far part and just have it say north, right? And like I said, they're going to use the Mount of Assembly to, you know, for the name. Now, what is the Mount of Assembly in the far north? Well, that's a mountain. You know, they're north of Palestine, up in Syria. I mean, they're actually talking about a mountain in Syria that was a sacred mountain, right? You know, and that's what's actually going on in Isaiah. You know, and some, you know, really modern translations won't even say the Mount of Assembly anymore. They'll put in the name of that mountain. Right? Okay, so there's something here, I think.
Why is it necessary to use scripture passages at all, at least in contexts like these?
Again, why is it necessary to use scripture passages? Because they're commanded to. The revelatory mandate commands. That if Bob said something that will work, they can't use their own expressions. Now, I mean, if in the midst of what we're writing here, there's something that the Apostle Paul said that works in describing some of this, even though Paul was not talking about anything about what we're reading about right here, then they'll use Paul's sequence of words. They're forced to. I mean, they had to prove that they went through everything that humans had ever written and could not find anything that any human had written that would be adequate in their sentence. And so, therefore, I wrote my own sentence. They had to justify their ability to speak freely. If they couldn't, prove that they had exhausted every possibility of using some human's phrase to say what they wanted to say, they were told to go back and try again. Right? They're not allowed to give you anything directly if they can find anything that is even remotely workable.
I just have a quick question.
Yep.
Is that English written or in the English language, or can it be any language?
No, it could have been anything, but then they have to translate it in English. They're pulling from all kinds of sources. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to
know. Yeah. Just anything that humans have, anything that's been recorded, about that we've written or that we've thought. I mean, remember a lot of they have all kinds of records of significant things that humans have thought. Remember how we've read about that. If there's something actually that's worth recording that happens in my mind, they actually record it. They have to wait a long time in between, punching the record button. But if for some reason I get a couple mind forms, they go, oh, that's we could use that somewhere. They record that. So.
Chris, in the 20s, was there only the King James version of the Bible?
No. You had a number of things going. You had the American Standard going. American Standard was in 1906, if I recall correctly. You hadn't gotten to the Revised Standard yet. Of course, but you had the Douay Rheims, you had the King James, you had the American Standard. You had the trend in scholarly work. It's interesting. Sometimes you'll see the way they'll tweak a Bible passage. Scholars have subsequently tweaked it, like that too. In terms of, what you might see in the Revised Standard or their New Revised Standard or the NIV, the New International Version. Some modern scholars have tended to improve the translation in a similar way that the Revelators improve it.
You're saying that the constellation is the inherently integrous level.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about the Lucifer's Manifesto. It's all built upon the assumption of deceit by those above him.
Uh-huh.
He assumes that they're deceitful.
Right. Right. Yeah, and of course, the irony for those of you on the webinar, he's saying, Lucifer's whole modus operandi is built upon the assumption that those above him are deceitful. Where does Lucifer end up going to deceit? He goes from default to rebellion. He goes from evil to evil and error to sin. Where it's not just self-righteous impatience, default, it's self-righteous deceit, rebellion.
Because he doesn't have faith or trust.
What was that?
He doesn't have trust. Lucifer doesn't have faith or trust.
Right. I mean, this is the big problem.
What do you mean he doesn't need it? That's what he would need in order to...
He thinks
it's a waste of time.
Right. He thinks he doesn't need trust.
Faith.
There's the fundamental problem for any being of relatively lowly status, like Lenonidex and below, out here in time and space, is time itself. Impatience. Because we are given this little thread of connection to eternity, it makes us impatient about time. Animals are not impatient about time because they have no connection to eternity. But you give one of us a little inkling of the fact of eternity, and it fills us with impatience. And that impatience builds to calamity, right? I mean, everything that is given to you from above is the seed of your own destruction if you don't play your hand well, right? I mean, you're fine until you're touched from above. Now there's issues. Now you have to have the clarity to not take what's been given to you above and flip it around and use it against yourself. You know, you can use your personality against yourself. This impatience thing is a simple way to appreciate why does Lucifer get into this mode? Why does he go down the path he goes? It's because of grace. If we weren't given grace, you could never get yourself into this false track of thinking where it appears that everything is just in naturally fine, that you don't have to consecrate yourself to some absolute law that just is and is nothing else. You know, and you're either in perfect consecration to that absolute law or you don't exist. You know, that absolute binary fact that lies, you know, at the absolute level. You know, because we're given this buffer of grace, it leads to this delusion that there is no absolute law. That there is, everything is just automatically, naturally fine. Right? And, things are just naturally fine like this, divine. You know, I'm innately divine. That it's grace that leads to the fall. If there wasn't grace, no one would ever think that there was anything automatic. Because they would watch the relationship of something that wasn't perfect to the bug zapper and notice there's nothing automatic. Either you perfectly conform to it or you cease to exist the moment you contact it. Right? You know? And it doesn't matter that grace is infinite. Right? I mean, grace is coming from infinite beings. Therefore, grace is infinite. But that's the whole point of what an absolute fact is. An absolute fact is that which can stand unmoved in the face of infinity. That's what makes it absolute. Absolute law is not diluted one tiny bit by infinite grace. It stands right there in the midst of a sea of infinite grace, unmoved, and you have to come to terms with it one day. One day, you're going to journey through the land of grace to the Isle of Absoluteness, right? Where there's no grace buffer between you and it anymore. And you either absolutely conform to its absolute demands or you cease to exist instantly, right? Remember what they say, if you try to put some object, in close to the center of all things there, it can't exist there, right? It's because of grace that Lucifer became iniquitous. The delusion that grace allows, it allows you to think that everything is just naturally like this, that there isn't any some sort of effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress involved. There isn't this long, difficult, arduous thing to get into relationship. It just is there to begin with. Okay? So don't fall victim to that, to the illusion that grace presents.
Difficult since grace was kind of automatic.
Yeah, right, yep.
Winston said, if I can understand you, if any other human source work, even a book, is found in the Urantia book, it does not disprove or prove the authority of these recorded or spoken thoughts that could be disillusional or possible evolutional in its nature.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, if you're reading something and you're thinking, well, I know humans have talked about that a lot. If you can't find a human source work, there's an issue. I mean, you know, you should always expect that if you could look far enough, you could find human source for something that's, you know, playing close to what humans have thought about. Because they didn't miss anything. They knew everything that had been written and thought. So, you know, it's the exception that there isn't a human source. Well, you know, I mean, and you know, who knows? You know, even things that are quite removed from anything humans have talked about, you know, they might still, there might be a phrase or something. I mean, they might be using
just
something. So yeah, I mean, so you just, you know, you don't want to be in that sacred text mode. You want to be ready to recognize that they've used human stuff very liberally. You know, because the point is not the words. It doesn't matter if it's their words or our words. Neither of them are truth. Right? None of the words of Jesus are truth. They're just words. They're facts. Right? Truth is not something that can be read. Right?
Well,
so,
before you go on,
yep.
You've confused me.
Mm-hmm.
The name Lucifer?
Yep.
So, I mean, is that the actual name of the being?
Again, none of us know his actual name. It's in something in the local universe tongue. I mean, who knows what the heck his real name is. But I'm pointing out the main reason that they decided to use, like, why did they decide to call him Lucifer instead of Satan? You know? It's because of this passage in Isaiah. This statement about what was going on in the head of the king of Babylon works so well for what was going on in the head of the system sovereign that Latin name for the morning star that's attached to those words, it's like, let's use that, right?
Yeah. It was like the lights went off even in their heads.
Right? They're going, oh, that's perfect. That's just like perfect. Right? You know, and then it's even better, the fact that since that was called, you know, since that word Lucifer appeared in Isaiah in the King James, you know, that word has gone negative. You know, it didn't mean the evil one back when it was being used there in the Vulgate, you know, for instance, you know, in Latin. It just meant the morning star. Right? But the very fact that it's gone negative since then, you see, all the more. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's gone negative. You know, and it matches up with this sentence. I mean, it, you know, it's just, you know, it's obvious that's the one they should use for him.
Yeah.
Right? It just works.
What a supreme slap in the face to Lou.
Chris, don't you think another reason, real quick, that they used the religious passages out of the Bible so often is because true religion develops deeper thinking. It can develop oftentimes, and the pattern here was similar. Pattern was usable.
Right.
It's a pattern of thought.
Right. I mean,
and you know, the religion often offers with the deepest thinkers patterns of thought that have a dynamics that just transcend what a non-religious thinker.
Right. I mean, again, I mean, and it's going to be a religious thinker who has some philosophical character that they're thinking too, even if they weren't a philosopher. Right. I mean, you know, they actually are not going to use Bob's words, you know, if Bob is just the run-of-the-mill schmuck, okay, because he wouldn't have had enough objective consciousness to put together a sequence of words that's going to be usable. Right. It's just like most scholars today couldn't be used as a human source work because they have so little relationship to objective reality that their sequences of words are not usable. Right, they're just too shallow. Right.
March says, I read truth all the time. I want to know what you mean saying truth can't be read.
Okay, let me just quickly remind you. I did it here a couple weeks ago, I think. They try to teach us this up in the Jesus papers. Let's see if I can quickly find that. Let's see here. That's paper. Let's see, what paper is it? Paper 132, section 3, paragraph 2. First sentence. Remember, no human knows the meaning of the word truth.
Wait a minute, 132, what?
Section 3, paragraph 2. The section is titled Truth and Faith. No human knows the meaning of the word truth. The dictionary doesn't tell you the meaning of the word truth. The revelation is trying to reveal the meaning of the word truth. Right?
Thank you.
And a very definitive statement. This first sentence in paragraph 2 is an effort to move you away from your false definitions of the word truth. Truth cannot be defined with words, only by living. So whatever this truth thing is, it's something that can't be defined with words, only by living. Your relationship to truth can only exist in the upper domain of your mind, where you're really living. It can't exist in the lower domain of the mind, where you're breathing and moving. I'm moving my arm around and this sort of stuff, moving my lips. It only exists in the temple within, any initial faint relationship to truth. Okay? It's the domain where you're really living, your domain of personalized mind, right? Your personalized self of spiritualized mind. Right? Truth cannot be defined with words. Truth is not knowledge, as they tell you another time very directly. You know, it's not a knowingness that can be given. Yeah? A simple way that you would imagine giving it is by writing it down and defining it with words. See, it can't be defined with words. That would make it knowledge, because you can hand words from to someone else. I can't hand you what's going on in the upper domain of my mind. I'm having a hard time even having a relationship to it myself, let alone being able to hand it to you. Right? Truth cannot be defined with words, only by living.
So what could she and the rest of us be getting when we're reading out of a book, or we're reading a passage, or a posting, or whatever,
facts,
and it just resonates what we call truth?
Well,
So
he was just saying we may have run out of time here. That's a complicated thing. I mean, it's something we actually are covering in the current presentation of Forging Egg and Donder Steel, is that very subject. You're getting some of the initial twinges of feeling on the second level of meanings, and at best they tell you you get a sort of exalted wisdom that comes up. But the challenge is to bring up something through the lower domain of the hourglass up into the upper domain, which is still not yet truth, but have it to be of a certain form so that the parallel truth is brought from above down into that upper domain. There was some relationship to truth in a revelator's mind. He killed that truth by taking it down into the lower domain of his hourglass and putting it out into words. It dies. I mean, they tell you, truth immediately dies when you bring it down and out. You know, so it's dead on these pages. You have to pick up this dead stuff, bring it back into your associating mechanism, back into the lower domain of the hourglass, exalt it up into the upper domain in just such a way, so well formed, that there is a parallel downreach that occurs. And truth is brought down from above your mind, from the spirit domain, above your mind, brought down into a spiritualization of your mind that has some relationship to truth again. And you want it to be the same truth that they had in their head in order for you to get the truth. Very difficult to achieve. Right? You know, if you don't have a very, very cosmically formed mind, if you bring that up in there, I mean, it's not going to resonate with the cosmos properly and have this reaction where the truth comes back down. You'll just get falsehood.
Chris, isn't resonating with the adjuster when you just say the spirit coming down?
Well, I mean, you know, think about how...
I mean, that's the idea.
The most immediate source for truth we have right now is the spirit of truth, not the thought adjuster.
Right.
Thought adjuster is the spirit of goodness. Spirit of truth is the spirit of truth.
Okay.
Right? And so, I mean, just all these details, these are things I try to bring out. We have all these basic presentations and seminars I've developed because there's all these very key elements that if you don't recognize, you know, you're just not going to get on the right page about what you're trying to do with this. If you're still thinking you can read truth, you know, it's not going to happen. You know, and it's like, how do I know that? Because the book directly says that. You know, probably in the part of the book that you've read, part four. Right?
I think it's really fun to think about. When they were putting this book together, you know, sitting in a boardroom, I imagine them sitting in a boardroom and working on vetting all the documents. Oh my gosh, that would have been interesting to be a bug in the wall there.
All right, well, let's get back to it here. Okay, so the passage from Isaiah, this is a very key passage. They're leveraging a whole bunch of stuff off of it. It's like, ooh, we can use that. And here's where you really see, you know, them... You know where the core of that usage is, and how it then branches into the whole book. All right. So you know he's thinking about remember he's an anarchist. You know he's flattening the hierarchy. It's not a hierarchy. There's anarchy. There's no levels. He's flattening it all down into a plane. That's what anarchy is. There aren't higher sons of God than him. He knows he's a son of God. He's a Nonendex son. And now you notice that he is immediately making one exception to his anarchy. There is him that's above the plane, right? Right. I mean, this always goes to self-righteousness and self-exaltation, right? And so he embraces the mantle that Satan gives him of the God of Liberty. I will exalt my throne above the sons of God.
Chris, quick question.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a self. That's not a personalized self anymore, right?
Well, no, I mean it's initially a very much a personalized
right,
self that's doing these things.
Yeah,
well, I mean, at this point, it's he's just exalting. He hasn't gone way down the road yet when he's still thinking like this. He purposed in his heart. Right? See, he's just getting going. Okay, let's keep going here.
The 100 system sovereigns come periodically to Edentia conclaves, which deliberate on the welfare of the constellation. After the Satania rebellion, the arch-rebels of Gerasim were wont to come up to these Edentia councils, just as they had on former occasions. And there was found no way to stop this arrogant effrontery until after the bestowal of Michael on Urantia and his subsequent assumption of unlimited sovereignty throughout all Nebadon. Never since that day have these instigators of sin been permitted to sit in the Edentia councils of the local system sovereigns.
Of the loyal system sovereigns, yeah. So now they're giving you the behind the scenes. Right? And the fact that there is this whole behind the scenes... It starts to get you wondering a little bit about Isaiah. Maybe it's not just a coincidence that there's a passage in Isaiah that works so well like this. You want to remember who this paper is written by. You know, if you flip to the end there, you see sponsored by Malvatia Melchizedek. Malavatia, Melchizedek. Or Malavatia, if you want to kind of, brought it all out. But you'll see for in a second why I'm parsing it that way. Yeah, remember, he's a being, so it actually isn't a TIA suffix. It's just an IA suffix. You know, he's the one who's something or other. You know, the IA part means. You know, there's a reason why I've got the etymology laying by my side here, you know, for this paper, because like we've noticed, a lot of times this etymology part is important. So let me just remind you of what you can find if you look in the etymology about Malavatya. Okay, the one who is, that's the IA suffix. The MALA, mala, is jaw. The word jaw in Latin. And the VAT stem is prophet. So it literally means the one who is the jaw of the prophet or prophets. You're going, well, that's kind of a weird name. Okay, now remember the Melchizedeks that are given a first name, like Machaventa or Malavatya or Matavandat, or any of those that are given a first name like that, it's because they're one of the 12 receivers. Right? It means they're one of the 12 receivers. The guy who wrote this book was on the planet when Isaiah was alive. He was overseeing all that prophet stuff. See, and by his name... The guy that wrote this paper. Did I say book? Okay. The guy that wrote this paper. Right? The Melchizedek that wrote this paper. All right, see, so in the annotation, in the etymology, I go on to say, so apparently, see, reflecting on that, the literalness of that name, apparently, this is the Melchizedek receiver who engaged the Old Testament prophets and gave them the quote-unquote messages from God. Or at least he's the one who made contact with Ezekiel and literally put words in Ezekiel's mouth. You remember how that story with Ezekiel, there's this little scroll, the words on it, and it gets put into his mouth. You know, this literal expression of him getting words and being literally a prophet like that. Him being given words. At the very least, that putting in the mouth, and Malavatya is the jaw of the prophets, or at least that one prophet anyway, like I'm saying. I mean, at least you know that much. Malavatya wrote the paper which reveals, the paper we're revealing, so I'm referring to, Malavatya wrote the paper which reveals that, quote, Daniel fully understood these matters. Remember how we read that last time? Regarding the various universe rulers, like we talked about last time. And you go, oh, that's interesting, because if you look in the book of Ezekiel, and Ezekiel declared that no secret was hidden from Daniel. There's a very curious parallel statement in the book of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel is like, well, how does he know that he can make this definitive statement about Daniel? Ezekiel declared that no secret was hidden from Daniel. It's like, wait a minute, that sounds really parallel to what Malavatya says in the paper, the Constellation paper. Well, what if Ezekiel's saying that because Malavatya is the one that was working with Ezekiel, so no wonder most likely Malavatya told Ezekiel exactly what we just read in the previous section. Daniel fully understood these things. You know, he informed Ezekiel that Daniel was not the run-of-the-mill prophet. He was a cosmic reservist, and was literally working with the planetary government. And then the fun thing about the name, there's a lot of times they have the immediate thing about the name, and then there's a lot of times there's an allusion too that's in play, and they recognize there's that illusion, and they're allowing that to be part of the significance of their coinage of the name. Because again, remember, his name actually isn't Malavatya. They're coining that name, right? No one on high speaks Latin, right? 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 They're coining that name for him. The name Malavatya also alludes to the wickedness of those who were usually the objects of the Old Testament prophecies, you know, like when we were just talking about the king of Babylon being the, you know, the finger that whose finger Isaiah was wagging, you know, at, who he's wagging his finger at. Anyway, so the wickedness of those who are usually the objects of the Old Testament prophecies is because mala is also the word bad in Latin, right? You know, you probably recognize a number of words that we have, you know, that have mal or mala, right, like malevolent or whatever, right? Right. So, see, so it has that illusion. But you know, it's like, well, how do you know that's not the direct one and that's the illusion? It's like, well, when you look at the other one, you know, and you see all these linkages to Daniel and the literal words being shoved in his mouth, you know, and all this, and you know, it's very suspicious. See that you put the dots together. I think we're reading the paper, you know, a paper by the receiver that is actually the one that engaged all those prophets, put those words in their heads.
That's good.
Right, and so the fact that there would be a statement that's referring to the king of Babylon that works really well for the actual system sovereign and what's going on, see how much of a coincidence is it actually, right? It's probably a usable sequence of words because Isaiah's mind had been trained a little bit by the way he had, you know, Malavatya was, you know, seeding his consciousness with thoughts about things. And
well, did he see him, or is just possessed thoughts in his
most head? Likely, and never saw any. I mean, it's obvious from the Bible that there was only, you know, Ezekiel obviously was being, you know, he was being engaged in a very overt way, you know, and he has this whole description of, you know, that we rationalize as some sort of a spacecraft or something like that, you know, but, you know, actually he was, you know, he was being engaged in a more literal way, not just mentally, but, you know, not to go off on that tangent, but, you know, and why they engaged him more literally than they did others, I don't know, but anyway, see, it all kind of comes around to, coincidentally, you know, when the Revelators wanted to put together the fifth epical revelation, and it was, and they were told they have to make it as evolutional as possible. They have to have it match up with all of the stuff that we've developed through the evolutionary process as much as possible, to not assault that. You know, coincidentally, quote unquote, there's all these things that they can pick up on, right? Discoveries that just happen to be made, and statements that happen to be said by Old Testament prophets, and you know, and so when all is said and done, they have everything they need to build the fifth epical revelation. Yeah. So you want to talk about seeing the end from the beginning? See how that all works in supremacy. You know, that's what I always mean by quote unquote coincidentally, right? There's a supremacy in play where there's a wholeness, where what happens through all of these seemingly random and emergency and interventionary and whatnot things that have gone on throughout all history, when all is said and done, you have all the parts you need to make the fifth epical revelation. And it doesn't seem as coincidental as it did at the time. I mean, was Malavatya thinking about the fifth epical revelation when he was seeding these thoughts in Isaiah's head? No, he had no idea, right? he would be an author of a fifth epical revelation one day, or that, you know, or anything like that, you know? but he can go, ooh, there are some things that I put back in there that I could use. when I kind of inspired Isaiah to say that one time, that could be used.
Yeah. Well, I have a question mm-hmm. on the inspiring or the seeding of
yeah.
this
thought. Yeah.
Like, we're talking, like, channeling, right? Or what
are we don't know what we're talking about. I mean, and, you know, none of us should make, you know, should you know, think we know exactly what how it is that the Melchizedek's engaged these people.
They're
I have
not
no.
Supposed to intrude
I don't
mind, right?
know how. Well, I mean, obviously they're. I mean, you know, you can they can engage their minds, their selves. I mean, they can't assault their free will. But you know, that's easy for most humans. Most of us aren't using our free will. Okay, so I mean, you know, they can engage us. You know, interact with our minds. You know, so, you know, it's exactly how it's done. I mean, it's like, you know, you remember how cryptic it is when they describe, quote unquote, how the reservists, the Destiny reservists are engaged. It's like, okay, I still don't understand how you're doing that. You know, they give all these vague references to somehow being able to seed their minds with thoughts, and it's like, well, exactly how are you doing that? I mean, right, I mean, it's not clear exactly how this is technically occurring. But in one way or another, in very subtle ways most of the time, these Old Testament individuals were being engaged. Because remember, the Melchizedeks are trying, even after Machaventa, you know, which had limited success, and they were still worried that this was the world was not going to be in appropriate shape for Michael to come. You can't uplift when there's no spirit to uplift. You know, they were worried it was just all going to evaporate. And so they were doing all kinds of exceptional things, you know, and they asked, it's like, well, what kind of things we can do? Well, no, you just do what you think you need to do. And so, well, we're going to pick out a few people and we're going to like really engage them and stick things in their heads and, you know, and we're going to try to somehow keep the light of truth going here. You know, and they tried all these exceptional things and it still really wasn't sticking. Even with all the potentials in the Hebrew peoples, they're pretty hopeless, you know. And they kept doing things, and they just immediately, you know, slip right through their fingers. And you know, remember what they tell you: if it wasn't for that the supreme getting into the act in the 6th century BC, and that quickening, you know, all of the efforts of the Melchizedeks, even all this really overt stuff like Malavati was doing, it wouldn't have been adequate. But coincidentally, the evolutionary process coming from the Supreme made up the difference. So between what they did and what the Supreme did in the 6th century BC, everything that was necessary for Michael to come, at least the minimum amount, was there. Okay. So, very complex process. All right. Let's keep going here. I forgot. We actually went on a little ways. We get off on these tangents, and I can't remember what we've done. Let's see. That we were talking about, right, so the behind the scenes. See, that you actually have these conclaves where the system sovereigns come up. And before Michael's a master son, they have to just all plug their noses and have Lucifer and Satan sitting at the table spewing their bile, right? You know, all over.
Brotherhood.
You know, and think about what an issue this is. I mean, you know, the split second that the rebellion was launched on Gerasim, the Most High's clamped down the circuits so this ooze wouldn't get out to, you know, out of the system, get to other systems, you know, or other constellations. Yeah, but they had no way of actually stopping these guys from, you know, hitching a ride and going there. You know, we won't get to the next section here tonight because we got off on such a long tangent. But we'll see in the next section that. There had to be all kinds of special things put in play to try to keep this clamp down because there was some leakage here in this, being, you know, a lid being put on this. You know, there was found no way to stop. In other words, they tried every parliamentary procedure and whatnot they could dream of to try to find some, you know, way to not allow them. But they were coming. So they were wont to come up to these Audientia councils, see, and it's plural, see, so it wasn't just one time. You know, there's a lot of times when they were doing this. So, let's see. You know, well, you know, as I said, he purposed in his heart. You know, I should be the one that has the residence on Mount Assembly, not that, you know, that doofus that's coming down from the foreign potentates, right? All right. So. But never since that day have these instigators of sin been permitted to sit in the Audientia councils of the loyal system sovereigns. And now you'll see a little addition to that that they explain here in a little bit.
That the teachers of olden times knew of these things is shown by the record. And there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Most Highs. And Satan came also and presented himself among them. And this is a statement of fact, regardless of the connection in which it chances to appear.
Okay, so notice they just say, regardless of the connection in which it chances to appear. It's like, well, what are those? Then they're going, you don't know? Know you not the Bible? See, I mean, you see how very literally, like I was saying, they're expecting you to know the Bible, right? They're not going to tell you where it is. It's a very famous passage. You should know it, is what they're saying. All right, we're talking about, you know, what are these oddball context they're referring to? It's the beginning of the book of Job. I don't know if you're familiar with the book of Job, and it starts out where there's this whole weird, you know, in this story, there's this supposed, you know, back and forth between God and, you know, and Satan and whatnot. You know, and so they're saying, well, yeah, none of that is actually, you know, valid. But again, that little line, yeah, that's actually pretty solid. That's a statement of fact, regardless of the fact that the context is in is not factual. Because of Job, you know, it's just a story. So, you know, that's the teachers. You know, remember, Job is a very complex construct. A lot of people in Mesopotamia are involved in bringing that into existence and stuff. So that's why they're saying teachers of olden times. All right, so, and there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Most High, so one of these conclaves, and Satan came also and presented himself among them. You know, and they're throwing that in as a little reminder that it's usually the case that Satan is the one that actually is out doing stuff. You know, that's what it means to be the deputy of the system sovereign, you know, to be his lieutenant. Is, you know, he's the one that actually goes and engages the worlds and whatnot. Lucifer is standing back. When on Mount Hermon, you know, Lucifer doesn't go and engage Jesus. You know, he sends his mouthpiece. You know, he sends Satan. It's very much like Tolkien does in Lord of the Rings, where Sauron, you know, the Dark Lord, you know, has a mouthpiece. You know, has a person he sends out. See, that, you know, that story is constructed on this fact. Humans have known this for a long time. See, it's part of our mythology. That the evil one has a, you know, doesn't actually go out and speak for himself. He has this mouthpiece that goes out and speaks for him. Dalagastia always did that for Caligastia. You know, Satan always did that for Lucifer. And see, so that's why, you know, when you intern Lucifer at Pentecost, but you don't intern Satan until the beginning of the 20th century. You know, if you wanted to put a quick end to what was going on, you would have done it the other way around. Because, see, the mouthpiece is still out roaming about. Lucifer wouldn't have been out going to the worlds anyway. You know, he would have sent Satan. See, so, you know, they're really doing a very minimal thing to intern Lucifer. He wouldn't have been out roaming anyway. So, You know, like I've pointed out, when you read that passage about Mount Hermon, the curious thing is why Calagastia is there directly and not Dalagastia. You know, that indicates that Calagastia is getting, you know, very desperate and grasping, you know. Lucifer's still cool, you know. He sends his his lieutenant. Yeah, because he doesn't want to look like he's, you know, worried or anything, you know. He's saying, you know, he's standing in the back. He might even be off in the distance, you know, you know, in eyesight, you know. But Calagastia, he is obviously, he's a little more grasping. You know, he's actually saying, no, Dalagastia, I'm going to go directly. And that's actually, you know, he's breaking protocol and everything. He's showing his loss of cool there by doing that. Yeah. Right. Okay. All right, so that's what they're talking about. You know, so that, you know, it may not have been many times that both of them, you know, were at these conclaves, you know, just Satan. All right.
Since the triumph of Christ, all Norlashadech is being cleansed of sin and rebels. Sometime before Michael's death in the flesh, the fallen Lucifer's associate, Satan, sought to attend such an indenture conclave, but the solidification of sentiment against the arch rebels had reached the point where the doors of sympathy were so well nigh universally closed that there could be found no standing ground for the Satania adversaries. When there exists no open door for the reception of evil, there exists no opportunity for the entertainment of sin. The doors of the hearts of all Edentia closed against Satan. He was unanimously rejected by the assembled system sovereigns, and it was at this time that the Son of Man beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven.
Okay, so there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. But you can see how, it's like, well, wasn't this supposed to be about the Mount Assembly and the faithfuls of days? Right, but see, because of that passage in Isaiah, see, you know, it's like, well, half of it's on that. The other half is on, you know, what's in play when you use that passage in Isaiah. It brings in the whole rebellion thing. okay, so sometime... sometime, it was sometime before Michael's death in the flesh. Now, you remember how... Jesus is interacting with the 70, you know, and they're all excited about how they seem to be, you know, that the rebel secondary midwayers seem to be responding to their influence, and it's in that context that Jesus said, I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. And in the Bible, that's in Luke. Luke is the only one that you know, because Luke did lots of sleuthing, you know, and he must have found some witness, you know, that would testify to Jesus saying that, and so it's in Luke. Between here and the other spot in the book where they talk about this passage, they're helping you to understand why he said that. See, so what happened is, just like they were quoting from Job there, there was one of these times that Satan, just Satan, was going to go to the conclave. And so you notice, like I said, they qualified that whole bit about never since, you know, Michael became master's son, you know, have the instigators of sin been permitted, you know, that line. There's a, you know, an asterisk on that. It actually, even before he was literally a master's son, the people themselves, they recognized that instead of, you know, there was found no way to stop. They forgot about themselves. They're looking in you know, the law and whatnot. What about our just the fact that we're persons and we can just definitively choose to not abide with that? Right? They finally recognized that. See, so you notice how they have a tendency to kind of get caught up in all the legal stuff. They're at the legislative level, and they forgot about, you know, their own just free will exercise, and just saying, no, you know, you will not attend. All right. You know, they recognized they had the power to just choose to not sit with him. All right. And so Satan was going to go to this, couldn't. And so in another spot in the book where they mention this, so that's why Satan came with Lucifer to this planet during Michael's seventh bestowal. See, so instead of going up to the constellation conclave, he fell from heaven, quote unquote, down to earth, right? He came with Lucifer down here, and you know, and then ended up being the one that Lucifer shoved ahead and was, you know, to face him on Mount Hermon and stuff like that. But see, the only reason that Satan was in play was because they wouldn't let him to go to the conclave.
His meeting was canceled.
Because remember, you know, I mean, it's going to be a lot of light years from here to Edentia. You know, see, so sometime before Michael's, okay, I mean, the actual event of you know, him being not allowed to go to the conclave was sometime way, way, you know, before Michael said that. Right, but so you know, it's all kind of, all those events are all compressed in that little statement, you know, that metaphorically Satan fell from heaven. He couldn't go to the conclave, came down to this planet with Lucifer.
So Lucifer did lose his cool one time when he came down to
Jesus. Right, yeah, I mean, you know, they were definitely, you know, they knew this was their last chance to make this happen. They could see their writing on the wall, pardon the Daniel pun, right? But I can't help myself. I'm reading a paper by Malavatia. You know, and, you know, sure enough, as soon as Michael became a master son, you know, Lucifer was interned. Right. So Lucifer knew it was, you know, the end of the road for him having free reign. But,
person.
Yep.
So they say lightning, so it makes me think he had luminosity still. And would he have lost that when he fell?
Well, no. Remember, they tell you that, you know, even, you know, into very recent times, they were still very luminous individuals. And you remember how recent it is that people stopped visiting, you know, Lucifer, you know, in prison, for instance. You know, you're still visiting him when he still has spiritual drawing power, you know, and he's still, you know, a very luminous being. See, that's the other reason why the word Lucifer, of course, works really well, because of its direct, you know, luminosity, reference. But, so in terms of them going totally dark and being ugly and not attractive at all anymore, That didn't happen until very recently, right? See, so this is the thing. I mean, Jesus asked to have permission as a man to face Kalagastia and Satan directly with all of their intriguing, enticing spiritual luminosity and their twisting influence, you know, and he got permission. It was decided that he could handle it. But remember how that worked. I mean, he was having to exert very aggressively to not be twisted by them. I mean, they're trying to corrupt his mind. They're trying to twist his mind. You know, it's not just some pleasant little back and forth, you know, a few words. I mean, they're literally engaging him energetically and trying to twist his mind. You know, and he was resisting that, but he was so exhausted by it that his guardian angels actually came back and helped him put his mind back in proper form, because it was a little frayed on the edges, right? Right. You know, if you or I faced one of them, they'd twist our mind instantly, and that would be the end of us, right? I mean, we wouldn't last 10 seconds, right? Right. You know, you'd just be a vegetable.
What about this? You know, a little bit confusing, yep. On this says ground for the Satania adversaries. Well, Satania is your place of adversity.
Right. Okay. Well, I was very good. I was just going to go to that next. You see, just as I pointed out, you know, the literal meaning of satania. I want, you know, see, this is what this is the very first time that the word adversary appears. It's right here juxtaposed. See, so, you know, if you haven't gotten it yet, because you're supposed to be interpreting Satania as the place or the nation of adversity, you know, let's put the word adversaries right next to it. Now do you get it? Right? Because, yeah. Yeah, see, so that's, yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, that's exactly what you should be noticing, you know, that, you know, there are adversaries, it's adversity, you know. But, you know, recognize you don't want to interpret it as the nation of the adversaries or the adversary either. Because that, you know, you think, well, why not? That would be more literal. The word Satan doesn't mean adversity. It means adversary. It's like, yeah, but, you know, think about it. That wouldn't be true. It's never been the nation of the adversaries. I mean, even in those 2 years before Laniforge, you know, it's not like they defined the local system. They were just a black spot in the white background of the local system. You know, so it's obvious, logically, that you need to tweak that a little bit and not just take it so simplistically as the nation of the adversary or the adversaries, but the nation of adversity. It is, they did turn it into the nation of adversity. The effort, struggle, conflict here is starker, right? But yeah, so very much they're wanting to think about the literal etymology there. Let's see here. You notice they did it again, the doors of the hearts. Right? Remember, we're not talking about the feelings on the second level of meaning. Right? The heart, the temple within. We're talking about the genuine personal consciousness, like they're finally, you know, really invoking and saying no to Satan. All right, so that's, see, there's all of this complexity, that statement from Jesus and all this, see it all. They're just showing you how you can fit all these pieces together properly and understand what's behind it all. You know, why would Jesus say that? I mean, obviously he's speaking in a way, you know, that will mean something to his audience when he's saying, I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. But, you know, they're pointing out it's not just kind of typical Armageddon speak, you know, that the people of that of the first century were used to hearing, right? There's some definite literalness behind it that they're trying to get you to recognize here, see? All right, let's finish it up.
Since the Lucifer Rebellion, a new structure has been provided near the residence of the Faithful of Days. This temporary edifice is the headquarters of the Most High Liaison, who function in close touch with the Paradise Sun as advisor to the Constellation Government in all matters respecting the policy and attitude of the Order of Days towards sin and rebellion.
Okay, and that will be our segue. I should try to remember to maybe just read that again to start things off next time. That's segueing into this next section where one of the people that they're going to talk about is that liaison. But so we'll pick that up next time. You can see just, you know, I mean, how appropriate really was that we kind of went off and talked a little bit about the use of the Bible and stuff like that. I mean, it's, you know, it's just very much in play in this section. Very instructive if you work through all these details of the section to begin to understand how it is that they're using, you know, human thoughts and words, you know, how this works, how they've used the names that they've used, and to get yourself in this this new way of thinking, so that you aren't treating this as just this book that you don't really reflect on, you just memorize and read, and you know, it's like, no, stop and think about it for a second. Lucifer is Latin. They don't speak Latin on high. Right? It's just as simple as that. The whole book is like that. You've got to move away from treating it as a sacred text. It's an elaborate construct, a masterly construct, and as being said on the webinar, it sometimes comes off as quite contrived. But that's because it's like, well, okay, that's kind of far removed, but it's close enough, so we'll use that. Remember, if it was even remotely, if they could rationalize it into play, they were supposed to do that. So sometimes it will seem like they're really, going pretty far afield to bring that one into play. But they're told to do that. Try to get it to link into as much of stuff as we have through our evolutionary development as possible. So that there's as many on-ramps as possible, as many ways that we can begin to resonate with it. I mean, if nothing else, you're initially kind of just in seeing it as a validation of sorts of what humans have thought and what's in the Bible and stuff. And it is doing that to a degree. The Bible's not wholly false. It's validating the Bible to a degree. But then the more when you start thinking about more detail, it's like, well, is this actually validating the Bible or is it refuting the Bible? It starts to turn around when you get into a deeper examination, right? But you recognize, oh, but it got me into it. Its familiarity got me into it. Especially if I only know the Bible kind of in a cursory fashion, I didn't notice the differences between what they were saying and what was in the Bible, and it didn't bother me, and it got me in, it got me interested, I felt comfortable, it felt familiar. That's the technique. All right, let's pause and reflect on all this for a moment here.